Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is May 8th, 2015. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. Today, we're going to start exploring the obstacles to peace, which Ken Wapnick refers to as the centerpiece of Chapter 19 in the ACIM textbook. Now, you're probably familiar with a commonly quoted phrase from the course, which says, you don't need to look for love. You need to find the barriers to love. Well, here the theme is somewhat repeated. Instead of looking for peace, we are encouraged to own up to the ways in which we throw up obstacles and roadblocks to make sure that peace is not really part of our life experience. Now, does that sound strange? Well, it ought to. What person in their right mind would create barriers to love and obstacles to peace? But that's one of the central themes of A Course in Miracles. We have a right mind, but so often that's not the mind we are operating from. The obstacles to peace, as described in Chapter 19, really are an affront to many of the beliefs we hold about ourselves and our lives. At first look, they might even seem preposterous. Obstacle number one, the desire to get rid of it, which includes the idea we are attracted to guilt. Obstacle number two, we believe the body is valuable for what it offers. Well, now that doesn't sound too crazy, does it? But as we explore this obstacle, we're told that we're actually attracted to pain, despite our protest to the contrary. Now, obstacle number three, the attraction of death. Really? I mean, really? Yes, really. And obstacle number four, the fear of God. Now, this one in particular is where many people draw the line. However, before you dismiss these ideas, consider that it doesn't take too much thinking or looking to demonstrate that most of us do not live in a state of peaceful bliss. So why not open our minds and consider this view of human nature? This is an important conceptual piece in A Course in Miracles. So we will barely scratch the surface today. We'll try to give you some ideas about it, but we're barely going to get into it. In fact, I was pulling a book off my shelf, one written by Ken Wapnick, and it's 500 pages long, and it's only on the four obstacles to peace. It's called The Journey Home. So if you're interested in what we're talking about today, or this intrigues you, you may want to check out this book. It truly, of all of Ken's books, it is one of my favorites. And you can find it at the online bookstore at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles at www.facim.org. Now, while you're listening today, please join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And if you haven't been there before, one of the easiest ways to get there is to go to the 12radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, you'll see a column and you'll see the word chat. Click that link and you will be automatically redirected to our group on Facebook. And that guy at the door ready to let you in is our producer, Scott Weaver. Thanks for being here today, Scott. And welcome, Bruce. I'm so excited about our conversation today.
Likewise, Sia. Thanks again for having me.
And I'm kind of really, laughing.
And I really enjoyed your preface. That was brilliant. When we really honestly look at the obstacles that we all have made to peace, you know, as you enumerated so wonderfully, it really is crazy, isn't it, that we would do this?
And it is absolutely crazy.
Yeah. It's all about being willing to look at our insanity and not take it seriously and to gently laugh at ourselves when we catch ourselves engaged in that. Those sorts of mental shenanigans.
Right. Well, and I am struck by the fact that, like I said, when I first started studying the course and I went through that section, I was like, you're kidding me, right? I mean, you know, thinking my body is important is an obstacle. Why is that an obstacle? And then when it got to, I'm afraid of death, or, you know, I'm attracted to death and I'm afraid of God. I mean, all the Catholic stuff started coming up and I'm like, okay, I'm not sure. This may be a little bit of a stretch for me. But of course, as you go through the text, you can't just stop there. As you go through the text and you keep reading it, you're going, oh my gosh, that's exactly what I do. Mm-hmm. And then you start understanding it. So then when I got, you know, Ken's book, Journey Home, I mean, it truly did become, especially in the early days of my studies, one of my very favorite books because it was so unbelievably right on. And just, you know, it's one of those things where you're like in the therapist's office and they're just calling you on all your stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's exactly what the obstacles to peace do. And I think it's so easy to just shut the book, shut the idea and just go, no, this just can't be true. I'm not afraid of God or I'm not attracted to death. But it's sort of like if you're willing to start looking at it, it makes more sense than any other, you know, sort of story that I'm telling myself.
Exactly. And it is a very universal, humbling experience to recognize that to the degree that we're invested in our egos, to that same degree, we basically short circuit and sabotage our own peace. I mean, that's how else could it be? I mean, because that's the only place where it can happen. And it's the only place where we can undo it. But that's really a tremendous gift to realize that and remember that where we can make a difference is in the mind, and that's why the Course in Miracles is reminding us, pun intended, that we need to get back to return to our mind and then choose a different thought system, choose a different teacher.
Right. Because, and the thing is, if this isn't true, then show me something that's more true or show me, it's like, how is that working out for you? Are we living in a peaceful world? Are we living individual lives of peace? Is that, you know, when you call me up and say, how are you doing? Do you go, oh my gosh, I'm just so peaceful, you know? Is that what I'm telling you? Or is I'm telling you, oh, that hot water heater broke down again or something. You know, I mean, just look at your life. And are you living in blissful peace? And if you're not, then I think it's worth looking at these obstacles.
Exactly, exactly. And so it takes radical self-honesty. Yes. To really look at those things, because most of the time, if you ask most people, they'll say, oh, I'm fine, things are going great. And then if you, you know, really probe a little deeper, or people just, you know, let their guard down, you realize, oh, well, yeah, I guess I'm having some issues around X, Y, Z. And then pretty soon, you know, the scroll unfurls and it goes down the street and around the planet a few times. But that's, you know, that's really all of our judgments and all of our resistances to peace. I mean, and it's intentional. I love how Ken Wapnick, you know, reminds us that it's so intentional that we have gone out of our way. In fact, you know, according to the metaphysics of the Course, we've gone so far as to avoid looking at the unconscious guilt that we shut ourselves out of our mind, and then in order to a secondary line of defense, you know, in these, what he calls the shields of oblivion, we made up a whole universe to hide out in.
I mean, right.
And we made up this victim-victimizer duality and the polarity of self and other, so that we would have something outside of ourselves to judge and condemn, to save a little scrap of partial innocence, which can never be real innocence, for ourselves at the expense of everyone else and everything else. And we don't want to look at those judgments. And those are, you know, those are the obstacles to peace among many. But, you know, the way that we want to, and again, it takes great honesty to look at that, the way that we want to maintain the belief in separation and use whatever comes across our path to reinforce it is really, you know, the little barriers that we need to look at. And I think the first part of the section on the obstacles to peace, it reminds us that you know, the little things, you know, the desire to get rid of it to start out with, you know, is it's nothing. I mean, it uses several different metaphors, you know, like feathers and a little wall of dust and and it's like they're nothing. You know, it's like the one section, one part here in the first section where it says the desire to get rid of it, the ninth paragraph of that says, how mighty can a little feather be before the great wings of truth? Can it oppose an eagle's flight or hinder the advance of summer? And it's very poetic here. Can it interfere with the effects of summer's sun upon a garden covered by snow? See but how easily this little wisp is lifted up and carried away, never to return, and part with it in gladness, not regret, for it is nothing in itself and stood for nothing when you had greater faith in its protection. And so it's basically reminding us that all the excuses and justifications and fortifications that we make in our mind against peace are nothing, and that we can really afford to look at those things when we're willing to question the very core, you know, foundation of the thought system that says that guilt is real. We shattered perfect oneness, and we don't have to do it all at once, but, you know, just little by little, if we just are willing to entertain some doubt that the life that we've been living is working for us. and I think that's where the brilliance of A Course in Miracles is. It erodes our attractions to guilt and to pain and to death, and helps us look at the resistance systematically and in a very progressive manner, whereby we can undo our addiction and our attractions and our fascinations with all of the stuff that doesn't serve us. I love how you say, you know, you said a moment ago, you're like, how's that working out for you? I love that phrase, because it basically is just saying, you know, if we really take a good look at what's going on in our minds, moment to moment over the course of our lives, we in all honesty, we'd have to say, you know, this isn't that fun.
Well, yes. And, you know, and I'm glad you said the thing that you did about that it's not that difficult. I mean, in terms of the sun, you know, on the snow, it's not that difficult to dissolve these obstacles, because quite real, you know, truthfully, that word obstacle, it's big, isn't it? You know, that's the word you use. It's not just a little irritation, a little challenge. It's an obstacle. And right. So that could lead us to believe, oh my gosh, you know, I'm never going to get through this. And yet it's not that difficult. With a little awareness and just the intention, we can just release them and let them go.
Yeah. It's like, you know, this ominous obstacle of, you know, this terrifying figure of the Wizard of Oz and
right.
on the screen there. And it's like, whoa, this is a big deal. And there's flames shooting up and, you know, booming sound and thunderous, you know, ominous stuff going on. And it seems like a big deal. But then our inner Toto, if you will, you know, pulls back the curtain, is like, oh, there's just a guy playing with levers and knobs. You know, it's like, this is not a big deal. It's just, that's the feather. That's the silly, tiny, mad idea that we took seriously and made up a really impressive and, you know, special effects galore world to impress the hell out of ourselves and convince ourselves that, oh yeah, I better take this thing seriously. And not that we shouldn't, you know, do the things in our everyday lives that, you know, make sense to us on a practical level. But if we can just begin to develop a little gentle smirk. And I'm thinking about an uncle that I went to a memorial for a week ago, and he always had this very kind nature and just sort of a gentle little smirk that was like, you know, you can afford to relax about things, and it was always a joy to be in his presence, because you knew that he didn't really take too much about life seriously. Now I'm sure he had his issues, but for the most part, when I think of my Uncle Joe, it's like, oh, he didn't take things quite so seriously. And I think we are drawn to people like that. And Ken Wapnick is certainly an example. And we were just talking before we started the recording about how, you know, his whole energy was that of this gently mischievous,
yes.
playful, humorous, attitude, and yet he could be very serious about, you know, admonishing in a kind-hearted way to us to look at our egos, because beyond that, beyond those obstacles, is the awareness that it's a joke. This is just a facade, a ruse, a hoax, a massive, massive joke that we've taken so seriously, you know.
That's right. And just as you were talking about Ken and kind of being mischievous, I was thinking he kind of had a look of an elf to him sometimes.
Uh-huh.
You know, he could kind of get that little sparkle in his eye and you knew he was up to something. You know, if you've ever seen him in a workshop or if you watch videos of him, you kind of see that spark sometimes or that little smile and you go, oh, okay, what's coming now?
Uh-huh.
And you can certainly hear it in his voice.
Exactly.
As you listen to his audio.
Yeah, and that's the quality that I think that the Course is it gently but firmly leading us inexorably to is to the willingness to look at these obstacles that we've put in our minds, and that's the only place they exist, and be willing to see that they're insubstantial. They seem, like you were saying, like to be a big, massive, mountainous, you know, galactic even obstacle at times, and yet even our modern physics tells us, you know, as a metaphor, that what we think of as, you know, a block of lead or a granite mountain or a planet or a, you know, red dwarf star or whatever, that it's mostly empty space.
Right.
And the thing that stuck in my mind from high school physics was, if you take an atom and make the nucleus of the atom the size of a you know, like a soccer ball or a basketball, the nearest electron, which are of course even smaller, they're just like, you know, hardly noticeable at all relative to the size of the nucleus. The nearest electron is like 4 miles away.
Wow.
So that's a lot of empty space.
Yes.
But we've made up this holographic, quote, reality, unquote, in such a way that, boy, I can, you know, put my fists on the table and on my desk here, and I get this feedback, this sensory feedback, and it seems real. But that's not just a metaphor for what we've done to the entire cosmos, this entire massive dream is really a hologram. It's just smoke and mirrors. It's empty space. And I think if we can look at the obstacles to peace in that same way, that it's a puppet show. It's a theatrical production. It's a movie. It's a dream. Whatever metaphor you like. And each of those metaphors, I think, holds the same content, that it's really okay to not take it seriously within our minds. And obviously in the level of behavior, we need to, you know, do certain things. But at the same time, we can, you know, chew gum and walk, so to speak, and look at the contents of our minds and say, oh yeah, I can go about my day doing all the things that I, quote, need to do, but without stressing out about it and without making my happiness and making my peace dependent on what happens or doesn't happen in the world, and looking at my judgments and my condemnations of anyone and anything as, you know, primary obstacles to that peace.
Right. Well, and you know what I'm thinking too is, as we look at the obstacles to peace, I think one thing that we can never let go of is sort of the basic foundation of what the Course is telling us, which is, why do we feel guilty, or why are we attracted to these obstacles? It's because we believe we separate it.
Exactly.
We believe the tiny mad idea. In fact, I want to read you something that Ken says in his preface, or in the very beginning of the book, you know, the Journey Home. He says, "The son chose the ego, and for one very simple reason, the ego offered him something the Holy Spirit could never provide, individuality. There is probably no single more important concept for a student of A Course in Miracles to understand than this one. The choice for the ego and against the Holy Spirit was the choice for individuality and a separate identity. Together with this go the parallel thoughts of autonomy, freedom, uniqueness, and most crucial of all, specialness." And so at the very heart of this, the reason we throw up these obstacles is because we believe that we successfully separated from God, that we have created this unique, special individuality, and we're hiding out. Like you say, we created a whole world, a hologram to hide out in, because we're afraid that God's going to figure out what we did. And so that's why, I mean, that's when some of this stuff starts making so much sense. Mm-hmm. Why would we not want peace? Or why would we be attracted to guilt? Because we feel like we're guilty.
Yeah, we're fugitives.
we're fugitives.
From a massive crime that our beloved Course reminds us never happened. I mean, we have to, you know, again, be willing to look at, as you were saying, the idea that we're getting some payback, we're getting some mileage out of this self. And that's, I think, one of the obstacles is, you know, that is mentioned here in this section, which is quite quite extensive, and as you point out, Ken goes over in even greater detail on the Journey Home book. But just real briefly, the belief that the body is valuable for what it offers is one of these primary obstacles, because we think that the body, and you know, which is really the puppet of the persona that we think we are, and this special unique self, you know, that's different from everything else and everyone else. We think that we're getting something from that, because we've convinced ourselves that is getting us to some who knows what kind of point. But if we really step back and look at it, it's like, well, okay, so maybe this body's around for a century, give or take, you know, if I take good care of it. And well, why? what is the purpose? And that's another kind of quintessential concept in the course, that it always asks, you know, what is it for? What's the purpose? Why am I choosing one thought system over the other? And there really, it always boils down to the two. There's either the inclusive thought system of love or the exclusive thought system of fear. And that the first section of the Attainment of Peace and the Obstacles to Peace, it, you know, really talks about that. It distills down to those two choices, love or fear, moment to moment. And we all get a choice to choose one or the other. And we're really attracted to guilt because we fear love, as the very first sentence says. The attraction of guilt produces the fear of love, for love would never look on guilt at all. So pretty crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's very crazy. But that's it, you know, but that very thing, once we remember why, you know, why are we throwing up these obstacles? And once again, looking at it, yeah, no person in their right mind would put up these obstacles, but we're not in our right minds. And so I find it really, it's very liberating to go through this section and just take it, you know, sentence by sentence and idea by idea about why we've kind of, you know, like in the course, they call it going down the ladder, you know, descending into the abyss of craziness. And that's what we do. Step by step, we do that. And we convince ourselves that that's a realistic way to live. You know, and to think and to be. And so I think it's just very powerful stuff here.
Yeah. Yeah. And the visual I kind of get for going down the ladder, and Ken talks about landing with a thud at the bottom of the ladder.
Yeah.
I kind of picture that as being inside a giant dumpster, you know, having bump, 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 bump down the rungs of the ladder, or maybe a giant trash chute in our mind. And ending up in the ego's dumpster, but we glamorize it. I mean, we've gone to great lengths to, you know, hire interior decorators for our dumpster
yes,
and to try to glamorize it, you know, and because we think this is it. I mean, and another phrase that I find really helpful in the course, that really, it can be liberating if we look at it, is the little you think you have, and the course doesn't ask us to try to you know, relinquish that. It just says just to look at it, and just to look at the little we think we have, and it kind of ties into the, you know, that section of the belief that the body is valuable for what it offers. We think that the pleasure we get in life is somehow different than the pain. We forget that in truth that they're identical, which is another kind of a radical concept that the course suggests, is that anything that's temporary is really the same thing. All illusions are equal, and the pains and pleasures that we identify as such are really the same thing, because they're really masking or covering over the unwillingness to look at the obstacle that is the belief that the body is somehow going to do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like what you were saying about hiring interior decorators for our dumpster. Oh my gosh, that is a great visual.
Well, I mean, isn't that kind of what we're doing? I mean, we try to feather our nests, and to you know, if it's not a physical home, it's whatever environment we think we're in. We try to make the best of what's an untenable situation, which is really it's a situation that's, we know. And I love that phrase, you know, how's that working out for you? Because if we're really honest, this world doesn't work for anyone. I mean, we all end up in the same crazy scenario of if we think we're bodies, then, you know, it's not that bright an outlook for what bodies end up as.
Yes.
I mean, well, it's not a very, you know, popular topic. And then and there's so much in our world that's meant to glamorize and to you know, and so why wouldn't we do the things that help us feel physically better and take care of our health and so forth? But the lengths that we go to make the body special and even just beyond, above and beyond the basic health and safety needs, you know, if you look at all the Maslow stuff, but we glamorize the heck out of it and rhapsodize about, you know, the body and it's like the course says, it's serial adventures, you know, and in terms of the relationships that we make so special. And we've already talked about special relationships, and that's you know, covers a huge amount of ground too, but that's certainly an example of an obstacle to peace is, you know, making our relationships and our bodies special and within the context of the dream world that we think we're in.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in this section too, I think it's in the first obstacle under the section that's on guilt, the attraction to guilt. Uh-huh. I will admit this part always just, how do I put it? I left after I read this the first time, I was just in awe. I mean, it was sort of like it read like a good horror novel.
Yeah.
You know, because he says relationships in this world are the result of how the world is seen. Mm-hmm. And this depends on which emotion was called on to send its messengers to look upon it and return with word of what they saw. Now, see, I love this from a logical standpoint because basically what we're being told is there is love and there is fear. Mm-hmm. And so are you in your life, you know, are you sending out messengers to come back to you and to prove to you that the world is love, or are you sending messengers out that will prove to you you're right? And I mean, this is, like I said, I love the logic of this because I'm kind of a firm believer that it's human nature that we don't form opinions based on information, but rather we form opinions and then we go get information to reinforce them.
Absolutely.
And in this section, I'm going to read this because, I mean, like I said, the first time I read it, I thought, oh my God. He says, fear's messengers are trained through terror, and they tremble when their master calls on them to serve him. For fear is merciless even to its friends. Its messengers steal guilty away in hungry search of guilt, and for they are kept cold and starving and made very vicious by their master, who allows them to feast only upon what they return to him. No little shred of guilt escapes their hungry eyes, and in their savage search for sin, they pounce on any living thing they see and carry it screaming to their master to be devoured. And I remember when I read that, I was like, I think my mouth was kind of open going, what?
Uh-huh.
But it was so descriptive because, you know, just in everyday life, I mean, think about it, you know, somebody says something or we find out somebody, you know, is on in the wrong political party or whatever it is. And that's exactly what I feel. I feel like I'm just ready to pounce. Like, I'm just going to wait, waiting for them to make a mistake.
Right.
And so when I read this, I thought, oh my God, how sad is that?
Yeah.
If I truly am living my life where I'm just ready for somebody to make a mistake so that I can make them guilty.
Right.
You know? And so am I looking for guilt? Am I looking for people doing the right thing? Or am I looking for people doing what I would consider the wrong thing? So the messengers that I'm keeping, and I've got the option, I can send out messengers looking for love mm-hmm. that will bring back those messages to me. Or am I sending out these birds of prey, you know?
Yeah. And that savage search for sin, the great alliteration there is what ego does incessantly, and it tries to disguise it. But it, like you were saying earlier, it really is a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, the reinforcing feedback of whatever thought system we're engaged in at the moment is impeccable, because if we're looking for guilt, we're going to find it. But mm-hmm. the last thing the ego wants to do is find it in oneself,
right?
The one's made up self, of course. It always wants to find it in somebody else. And so I was actually, this came up in a conversation yesterday. It's like, well, talk shows would just totally disappear. I mean, well, not this one, but most of what's on, you know, popular media would go away if it was like, if you didn't have scapegoats and groups of people and specific individuals to throw darts at and to lampoon and to satirize and so forth. And it's really all about the intention, isn't it? So, you know, what purpose? It all boils down to. And each purpose, of which there are really only two, love or fear, has its results that match perfectly. And there's like hermetically sealed in the sense that, you know, those two thought systems never touch each other. They never, but we are so skilled that we can flip back and forth between the two in a split second and not even realize it unless we're being mindful of how we feel. And that's really it, is when you find someone being kind, and when you choose to be kind, truly, that then you've basically thrown the knife switch. You know, you've used that decision-making faculty of the mind to say, okay, in this moment, I'm choosing to see my interests as the same as someone else's. And you might acknowledge, for example, if let's say you're watching a talking head show about, you know, political situation or environmental situation or something where there's an obvious attempt to make a scapegoat out of a person or a company or a political party or whatever, you can watch that and see, oh, this is a projection of my own unconscious guilt to the degree that I want to judge and condemn this person or persons for what they seem to be doing. And recognize that, you know, that's basically an obstacle to peace. I'm choosing against peace when I choose to be upset. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, you don't necessarily take action and get involved in whatever cause or you know, charitable donation or whatever. You know, it doesn't mean that, but it means that you can see that everyone's interest is really the same, and that if any attempt to exclude anyone from the best outcome for all is involved, then we're, you know, playing back into the savage search for sin again. We're trying to make something other wrong or guilty or in some way less than perfect oneness, which is just a microcosm of the macrocosm of the unconscious guilt that got us into this silly dream in the first place.
Right. And, you know, I was thinking, I'm an astrologer and I also do tarot and I love those. And I know they're illusions, but I absolutely love them. And I was talking to somebody about one particular card the other day and explaining that when this card comes up, often it's an indication of, I'd call it, you're loaded for bear. You know, it's sort of like you're the warrior, you're ready. You know, you've got your guns, you've got your defenses, you know what the past has been and you are ready to take it on. And so if that's your attitude, if that's where you're coming from, then you're looking for a fight.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard not to be looking for a fight. But I was also thinking about specifically dogs and my dogs, because they can just be wonderful. They can be incredible, but we can be walking along and there could be a dog fight in the dog park or, you know, somewhere. And my dogs want to join in. And it's sort of like, you don't even know what those dogs are fighting about. You know?
That reminds me of a quote. I'm not sure if it was Mark Twain. I'll have to look it up. But it's something like, is this a private fight or can anyone join in?
Yes, but that's exactly how it.
And that's how our egos work. I mean, and even if we're not physically involved, you know, when it's something on, you know, across your computer screen or your TV or your radio or newspaper or whatever, you know, or just something, you know, you hear in conversation at work or at home, socially, whatever, anything that basically raises the hackles, right. Whether it's physically, you know, hair in the back of the neck, or if it's just an internal upset of any kind, no matter the magnitude, in that moment, if we're alert to it, we can say, there's that maladaptive thought system trying to get into the act again and shut down the peace that is possible in this moment. If I were to look at it with my inner kindness teacher and say, don't go there.
Yeah. You know. So see, that's it. That very first obstacle, trying to get rid of it,
yeah,
you know, is very much like, to me, the dog fight.
Yep.
Of, you know, you're just itching to get into it with someone. reality.
Oh, yeah.
And for what even reason? It's not even your fight. And I love that quote, you know, can anybody, is this a private fight or can anybody get into it?
I'm paraphrasing probably, but that's.
No, but I recognize that it does sound like Mark Twain, but, you know, it could have even been George Bernard Shaw or.
Somebody like that.
Somebody like that. Yeah. But. You know, but when you recognize that's what you're doing, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, I'm just ready. I've got my defenses on and I'm looking for a fight. I'm looking for somebody to just try to knock this chip off my shoulder. And so once you start exploring some of those things, you realize we really do try to get rid of peace.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah. There's another section, I forget where, I believe in the text where it says, you know, if you get involved and I'm going to paraphrase this again, but you suddenly realize that you've got your swords drawn, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, oh yeah, I guess I am, you know, looking for some kind of conflict. And that's the drama royalty that, you know, that we all are, if we're willing to admit it, that as long as we're trying to make the world a certain way and we're attached to the outcome, and have expectations about, well, I want this to happen this way and this to not happen this way. And if we were to, you know, make a list of all those things, they would be legion. They would be, again, you know, like a scroll that would unfurl and out the door around the neighborhood and around the planet a few times of all the things that we would prefer to have happen, you know, one way and not happen another way. And to the degree that we're invested in those outcomes, to that same degree, we're saying, I'm not that interested in peace.
Right. And, you know, like when somebody, every once in a while, something will happen and somebody will say, oh, well, I didn't mean for that to happen. And I'll say, but did you mean for it to not happen?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of look at me, but it's sort of like I kind of look at the situation and to take something that this, I mean, there's a lot of things that would kind of incite not good thoughts. So I'm going to go with something a little more even scale or like, for instance, if I said, I really didn't plan on eating any sugar today, and then you walked into my kitchen and I'd baked a dozen cookies, then I said, wow, I really wasn't planning on eating sugar today. Then you would have every right to go, well, were you planning on not eating sugar? I mean, were you planning on that not to happen?
Uh-huh. You know,
what are the cookies about? And see, that's what I find myself and other people doing all the time is we like to say, wow, I didn't really plan on that happening. But did you plan for it to not happen?
Right.
And I would say no, because we were ready for it to happen.
Yeah. So, another good metaphor is to kind of look at our inner shopping cart and which ends up in our inner pantry.
Yes.
Because, I mean, the things that we buy, you know, metaphorically, are the things that we consume. And, you know, so if we look at the nature of our thoughts as our provisions, you know, what we feed upon. In fact, that the first couple of paragraphs in the section you just read from actually tie in beautifully. Should we just read those? I mean, because
go ahead.
Okay. So this is the attraction for guilt. And it talks about, you know, what fear would feed upon. So it starts out, the attraction of guilt produces fear of love, for love would never look on guilt at all. It is the nature of love to look upon only the truth, for there it sees itself, with which it would unite in holy union and completion. As love must look past fear, so must fear see love not. For love contains the end of guilt as surely as fear depends on it. Love is attracted only to love. Overlooking guilt completely, it sees no fear. Being wholly without attack, it could not be afraid. Fear is attracted to what love sees not, and each believes that what the other looks upon does not exist. Fear looks on guilt with just the same devotion that love looks on itself. And each has messengers which it sends forth and which return to it with messages written in the language in which their going forth was asked. So I think that's, you know, the mutually exclusive nature of love and fear is brought out so perfectly here, is that you know, as long as we're in one thought system or another, we're going to reinforce exactly the nature of that thought system moment to moment. But the beauty is that we do have a decision-making mind that can get us out of the default craziness, which is what we call ego, and restore to us the right-minded thought system that we never left in truth, but you know, we've made up this incredibly convincing, massive dream that is self-reinforcing, that keeps bringing feedback in terms of an entire cosmos that tells us, oh yeah, this material dream is real, and you should really be afraid and take it seriously, you know. And it's just crazy. But we have a different interpretation possible, and that's where if we practice the idea of shared interest, where my interest is no different from yours or anyone else's, and include everyone, which is, as Ken Wapnick points out, one of the really challenging things of the course. In those moments, when we are willing to look at that idea, then it ties into what it says next here. Love's messengers are gently sent and return with messages of love and gentleness. The messengers of fear are harshly ordered to seek out guilt and cherish every scrap of evil and of sin they can find, losing none of them on pain of death and laying them respectfully before their Lord and Master. And I think that's where ties into where you started reading.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of jumped over this gentle part, didn't I?
Well, but it's important to look at it. And I think it's important to recognize that our minds have the capacity for both, and that we have that option to choice of choosing every single instant. In fact, to just, you know, touch on a physics idea that really kind of got me thinking a few years back, I was in a group called New Frontiers, the Gold Country, and there was a lady named Robin McWane who'd been studying modern physics, and she gave a talk to our group, which it spanned about 9 years. And one of the evening talks, she was talking about modern physics and touched on what's called the Planck constant. There's a time and a space constant, and she was talking about the time constant. And from what she could gather as a you know, lay physicist, if you will, the Planck's time constant is this incredibly tiny little slice of a second, which is 10 to the minus 44th second. So if you imagine, you know, a tenth of a second being a really, you know, quick little blip, a hundredth of a second, well, that's quicker than video flickers on your TV if you have one of the old type sets, or your computer refreshes at about mm-hmm. that rate. So if, imagine 44 zeros. You know, keep going to tinier and tinier little pieces of a second. So if you imagine 10 to the minus 44th second, which is a really, really, really quick stroboscopic blink of time, according to what she was saying is that the universe winks out of existence and is restored in its entirety that many times a second.
Wow.
So 10 to the 44th times per second, which is, you know, roughly the Planck time constant, we have an opportunity to choose again
what it will come back as.
Yeah. Now we don't perceive it that way, but that's like an example of the power of our minds, and we go out of our way. We've rehearsed this role of these dream figures with these obstacles that we cherish, and we relish the agonies of a belief that we're separated from perfect oneness. And we've practiced this with such finesse and such theatrical skill that, you know, it seems like this continuous movie, but it's actually this stroboscopic thing that flashes in and out of existence, you know, gazillions of times per second, at which we're making this choice either for the thought system of shared interests and perfect oneness and inclusion and kindness, or we're choosing against all those things, and we're choosing the ego's crazy, insane, but silly idea that we could possibly be apart from everyone else and everything else, and ultimately God, which ties into one of the other obstacles. You know, we're actually afraid of that perfect oneness. We're afraid of God. We're afraid of lifting the veil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and to pick up where you were reading before, mm-hmm. to kind of end this piece, is perception cannot obey two masters.
Right.
Each asking for messages of different things in different languages. What fear would feed upon, love overlooks. What fear demands, love cannot even see. The fierce attraction that guilt holds for fear is wholly absent from love's gentle perception. What love would look upon is meaningless to fear and quite invisible. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of goes back to what you were talking about with that, the universe winking in and out, is in every moment we get the choice. Mm-hmm. Of love or fear.
Yeah.
But, you know, we get to choose. And I also love your analogy of the pantry, because I think about, yeah, what are we storing in the pantry? You know, what are we putting in there? You know, mm-hmm. what is our guiding principle for those stores, for those resources that we have? You know, and are they guided by love or are they guided by fear and looking for our own guilt or other people's? Because that's what we're going to draw upon.
Yeah.
When it's time to make dinner, we're going to go to the pantry. And when it's time to react in the world, we're going to go to our internal resources. And what are we storing up?
Yeah, it's like ego is mental junk food, and if that's all we're putting in the cart, that's what we're going to find in the cupboard there.
Yeah, once again, I love these analogies that you throw out. I always just I have such a good time with you.
Well, good, good. I likewise. I think you've really been hitting on some of the brilliant aspects of this section, which really are. You know, very profound. And that last little part that you read in the second paragraph of the attraction to guilt section is carried through again in paragraph 14 on the facing page there, at least in the version of the book I have. And it talks about love's messengers. And maybe I just read that paragraph.
Okay.
Because I think it really helps to not only look at the craziness of the ego, but also to remind ourselves that we're developing and building. And not that we're actually having to make it up, but because it's already there. We're basically restoring the awareness to the thought system of what we really are as one being that really offers the hope and the solace for, you know, that replaces the craziness of the ego. And so this is where it says, the Holy Spirit has given you love's messengers to send instead of those you train through fear. They are as eager to return to you what they hold dear as are the others. If you send them forth, they will see only the blameless and the beautiful, the gentle and the kind. They will be as careful to let no little act of charity, no tiny expression of forgiveness, no little breath of love escape their notice. And they will return with all the happy things they found to share them lovingly with you. Be not afraid of them. They offer you salvation. Theirs are the messages of safety, for they see the world as kind. And that's, I think, you know, the example that I was mentioning earlier of my smiling uncle that comes to mind when I, you know, think about him and Ken Wapnick and so many people that I think we can all look at in our lives that have been exemplary, that we just like being around them because we feel good in their presence and they make us feel welcome and comfortable and we look forward to, you know, companionship. And I think if we can remember to do that with everyone, and extrapolate that lesson, that quality is not something that really needs to be limited to specific individuals or groups. That if we can look at the attraction to guilt and replace it with the attraction to love, that really is done by undoing the attraction to guilt, and the love that's always there will just be self-evident, and that's when those messengers bring the feedback that we really want.
Right. And just to kind of end this segment, because I realize we are getting close to our time, but I want to continue with where you were reading. It says, if you send forth only the messengers of the Holy Spirit gives you, wanting no messages but theirs, you will see fear no more. Mm-hmm. The world will be transformed before your sight, cleansed of all guilt, and softly brushed with beauty.
Exactly.
So there you go. What a great note to end on.
Yeah.
And so as we do end the show today, thank you so much. And next month, I really would like to continue to explore the obstacles and to talk a lot more about what some of these things mean. But in the meantime, do you have any announcements that you'd like to make?
Actually, I do. I, in addition to what I generally post a few things once a month on ACIM blog and also the similar page on Facebook. And I always like to remind people that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, facim.org, has wonderful resources. I've been going through the FAQs there, in addition to the Lighthouse and the selected essays and just all the videos and just wonderful stuff, as well as the bookstore. There's also here locally in the Denver, Colorado area, an organization called the School of Reason, and Lynn Corona basically just I just added a page to help her with her website, she just had me add a page which has the lending library that the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center has, and there's a whole bunch of great titles. I think there's 40 or 50 CDs, and then three dozen or so MP3s. So if you're in the Denver area, you might want to check that out, and also avail yourself of a lot of the classes that are there that Lynn and Susan Dugan and Tim Wise and several other instructors there have just wonderful programs, and so you might want to avail yourself of those.
Oh, that's good, and that is a good reminder that they do have that lending library for people that are local to the Denver area. Okay. All right. Anything else?
Oh, that's probably plenty for now. Thanks again for having me on your show.
Well, Bruce, thank you. And by the way, thanks. You always come up with great topics, and I so appreciate that. Things that are very provocative and just things that I need to be reminded of. So thank you for suggesting the obstacles to peace. And there is so much more material here. So I know that we can get into this in the next few months.
There's lots. And I also thank you because it helps me remind myself that I need to look at all this stuff and by doing that, we get that opportunity, don't we?
That's right. So, Bruce, thank you very much, and I'll talk to you next month.
Okay.
And thanks to you listeners and to everybody in the chat room for making A Course in Miracles part of your day. And thanks to Scott Weaver, our producer today. You can find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring, and coaching on 12listen.com. And you can also find me on Tuesdays on my other show, Simple Tales, where we discuss one of my favorite illusions in the dream world, astrology. I'm live every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 Eastern. You can also find me on Thursday evenings on 12 Academy discussing astrology basics. You have about 5 minutes to get yourself another cup of coffee or tea or get a snack and be back in time for The Through Line with Christine Dumouriez, coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 12 Radio. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 12 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.